This is Hope on the Front Lines from NHPR. I'm Rick Ganley. The opioid abuse problem in New Hampshire has many facets. And today we're looking beyond the police reports and government policies. Producer Michael Brinley and I check in with volunteers and professionals who are tackling this problem, working to pull people out of the downward spiral of addiction and help them put their lives back together. One such team of volunteers is CASA, Court-Appointed Special Advocates. Their mission is to represent and advocate for neglected or abused children in the state's court system. And as more parents are dealing with addiction, CASA sees those issues coming to bear on more and more of their cases. They report that nearly 70% of cases last year involved Granite State families affected by substance abuse. And many of those cases involved parents addicted to heroin or other opioids. Jennifer Westover of Concord is a volunteer with CASA. She's worked on two cases that involved parents struggling with drug addiction. I spoke with her about her role in those cases and began by asking her how she ended up volunteering for CASA.
I have worked in the court system before and worked for an administrative judge in the past, so I'm familiar with working with the public when they're not in their best times of their lives. About 4 or 5 years ago, I decided not to work. My husband and I decided that I would not work, and I was looking for something to do, and I wanted something that was rewarding, that would give back to the community, but I also wanted a challenge.
I know you have to talk in general terms here, of course, because of cases, but what do you generally do with these families and these children? What's your particular role on it on a daily basis?
Well, I mean, my objective is to get in there and really see what's going on so I can tell the judge, you know, are they going to the counselor? I mean, DCYF is also doing this hand in hand. You know, and give my perspective of how they're interacting with their child.
They want you as another set of eyes.
Yeah, and my eyes, when I write my report, I'm thinking, if I was that child, what would I want to tell the judge about my parents? You know, I want them to straighten up and fly right and take care of me, but I have to go into specifics like, you know, yes, you know, this parent was wonderful and they've attended all their counseling meetings, they've had negative drug screens, you know, they've accomplished this, or they didn't, or they got arrested here. Not that I'm sure the judge can find out, but I'm telling my story of what I've gleaned from going to the home and visiting with them, and we have meetings that we go to where everybody comes to the table and we talk about their progress.
And you volunteered in a couple of recent cases that then have to do with parents struggling with addiction. What's your role in those types of cases?
Initially, when you get started in the case, it seems like they're not really present. They're more concerned about getting their next hit, or however you say that. They generally don't understand who I am for a while. They just know that I'm always there, and I tend to focus more on cheerleading them to encourage them to hopefully make the right choices. In one case, I got to watch a parent change and fight her addiction and win and become a totally different person in the end, a wonderful person. Not that she wasn't as an addict, she just was not making the right choices. Her child was not the most important thing in her life. That was kind of, you know, forgotten. Wasn't sure it was going to have a nice outcome. It wasn't like it was clear from the beginning that they were going to succeed in their addiction recovery. But then you see them change over a period of months where they do start looking at you in the eye and they start, you know, saying things about their child. I mean, they and it's a gradual process, and they may screw up, they may, you know, but in the end it was very, very rewarding. I mean, you're just like, yay, you know, we did it. And in the very end, to have the parent come up to me after it was all said and done, they were reunified with their kid, to come up to me and the DCYF worker and talk normally and talk about the kid and what's going on and all of that. Just, it was wonderful. They were just such a different person from when we began the case.
Yeah. I was wondering if I could ask you, I don't know if there's, you know, a common thread of the addiction cases that you've worked on. I think you talked to some of that, but are there differences in the cases that you've seen when it comes to addiction?
I've been involved in a case where there was a family involved outside of the parents, and where there was no family involved. And it was a radically different outcome. Having the family involved and being there every day. You know, I'm not able, DCYF worker, we're not able to be there every day to prod the parent to, you know, come on, you need to make the right choice, you know, do this, you know, you need to get to the counselor. But the family being involved and giving them rides and or whatever, getting them to the doctor, made a remarkable difference in my eyes. I mean, I'll go on from here to have other cases. I may change my mind in that. But the one case where the family wasn't involved, it ended in termination of the both parents' rights. So the kids were adopted, which turned out happily for them in the sense I'm very pleased with where they are. But it's also very sad that they're not with their parents and their parents didn't succeed.
Mm-hmm. Through your work on the cases that you've seen, what do you take away? Is there anything that you learned about addiction and the nature of addiction?
That it's really sad when someone becomes an addict because, I mean, it's just sad that they ever introduced that into their lives for whatever reason. I mean, I've learned that some people become addicts because they're self-medicating. Being involved with someone who's an addict and then seeing them change into someone whose perspective isn't for the drug, definitely changed. I mean, in my private life, I've never been involved with someone who's an addict, so it was very eye-opening. And I have to mention that CASA is wonderful at giving us education about. It's been a learning process for me. I'm exposed to people who are addicts, along with. We're required to get continuing education each year. So we're educated and we go to seminars on different types of drug abuse or there's all kinds of, you know, things out there that we attend. But I've kind of focused in on that because that's what my case was about.
You've talked about, going through two cases in the course of 4 years, 5 years. I mean, there must be a huge need.
Yes, there are not enough CASAs at this point to cover all the cases in the state of New Hampshire. So there's a very big need for people to become CASA volunteers. You know, it would be wonderful if we could get more people to volunteer. I think they would really enjoy the experience. It's a challenge, yes, but it's very rewarding as well.
Jennifer Westover, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
That's Jennifer Westover, a volunteer with court-appointed special advocates. We go now to Keene, where, on a recent Saturday afternoon at the fire department, a handful of people are learning how to use the now widely available overdose reversal drug, Narcan.
Your kit will look like this. It has the instructions on the outside. It's calling 911.
It's one thing to get it into the hands of those who may need it. As I find out, it's another to know how to use it properly.
You put your thumb on the bottom. It's got hash marks on the side, so it said half and half in each nostril. You don't have to be a scientist here. So you're doing about half in each. If you do the entire dose in one nostril, it's okay. You have done no harm. All you've done is reduce the surface area.
Tricia Wadley is with the Greater Monadnock Public Health Network. She demonstrates putting together a Narcan kit for the class. It's a clear syringe with an atomizer, which turns the liquid into a spray. People here today get a free kit, but the training is also an opportunity for people like Bill Davis to ask questions.
Does it work on Suboxone and methadone?
Yes.
So if they're overdosing or have used too much of those substances, this can help block those receptors in the brain.
Later, I pull Davis aside, and he opens up about his own struggle with heroin addiction. It started with a back injury that required surgery.
After the operation, I got some pretty serious narcotics. I didn't do the rehabbing like I should have. Once they cut you off the stuff, I was sick. I had no idea what hit me. I really didn't know what opiate sickness was.
Davis is now clean and in recovery. And while he hopes he never has to use his Narcan kit, he still knows people stuck in that cycle of addiction.
Like they say, relapse is a part of recovery. Well, let's hope they don't relapse, because if I see somebody in an overdose, and at least be able to hand them some of this. I just don't really want to see nobody die. And if I can help, I will.
The kits being handed out today are part of the 5,000 the state dispensed last fall, paid for through a federal grant. Tricia Wadley, the trainer, has handed out more than 300 of those kits in the region since December. She tells me the people who come out to these kinds of trainings are usually dealing with addiction issues in their lives.
So these are the mothers who are knocking on their daughter's door 3 times a night to make sure that they're awake. They're the wives who are checking on their husbands multiple times during the day. They're the children who are checking on their parents multiple times a day. The kits were really, the idea was to get them to the users or the folks who are struggling with addiction and then their closest circle.
She's done nearly 20 trainings since December, mostly at local businesses, healthcare organizations, and public schools.
And maybe we're not necessarily dispensing kits all the time, but they're definitely interested in the education. So we've had a little bit of uptake on folks who are interested. And we try to meet that need, whether it's on a Saturday like this, or during the workday, or after work hours.
It's obvious just how much of a need there is. First responders with the Keene Fire Department tell us they've used Narcan nearly 60 times this year. Compare that to only about 20 times during the same period last year.
Narcan is nothing new to us. We've had it for a long time. But what you're starting to see is what's mixed with, okay, you're getting the heroin. What is in that? It's laced with fentanyl. We talked about the way they're manufacturing. How do they make it cheaper for a better profit margin?
Jim Pearsall is the training lieutenant for the city of Keene. He says that dangerous mixture means many overdose victims now need several doses of Narcan to be revived. And Pearsall says they're seeing the same people over and over again. He tells the rest of the class about one of those people they're seeing frequently. It's actually someone he knew growing up.
I brought him back 9 times. 9 times. It kills me every time I see him. This is happening to everybody. It's affecting everybody. You know somebody that is affected by this. You're taking a step here to help people out.
Good recoil, but don't bring your hand off the surface of the chest. Leave it touching it.
And you got to have that rhythm right to make it really effective.
One, and two, and three, and four.
We're learning CPR today as well. First responders say it's not always enough to have a Narcan kit. As we're down on the floor practicing chest compressions, a call comes in. There's a needle on a nearby street. Pearsall says that is happening virtually every day.
We need to be policing ourselves, policing our kids. Hey, don't touch that. Okay, if something looks suspicious, call. We're here.
This is the second CPR Narcan training hosted at the fire department this year. Both were organized in partnership with a local advocacy group, and that group is called Keene Hates Heroin. Jessica White founded the group last year after losing several friends to overdoses.
Addiction has been in my life. All growing up, have family that's addicted in different ways, and some personal experience. So kind of just a natural calling, I think, at some point, just realized that there's a lot of gaps in the community that if you put your mind to it and are determined enough, you can help kind of bridge those gaps.
The group holds community meetings where people come together. They talk about why people are using and how to support recovery. She sees Narcan training as one more way to help.
Narcan is definitely not a solution. It's but if it's used as a means to open up that conversation with more people, if somebody walks in the door because they just want that training, just because it's the thing right now, at least I got them in the door, I got them engaged in conversation, and now they've been exposed to a wider mindset.
The IN's good, and whatever you do, you're going to save a life by using it. And we use it because, you know, a lot of addicts, their veins are junk.
And there was plenty of conversation. People share personal stories and hear first responders talk about what's happening on the ground. Diane Marr is also here. She's a school nurse in Keene, where officials recently approved stocking Narcan in schools.
We've had incidents of staff, we've had incidents of students, we've had incidents of parents, so it's just one more thing in our toolkit. And as RNs, we're used to this sort of a delivery method.
And Tricia Wadley, the trainer, tells me these sessions are also an opportunity to debunk some myths. Narcan can't get you high, and she's seen no evidence to support the argument that making it more available would encourage users to push their limits.
There's a lot of misinformation out there. There's a lot of very personal opinions and very passionate personal opinions that might not be based in any science or logic, but it's really hard to break those down. And so being able to educate folks with about a simple option to save a life is a really powerful thing.
This kind of training is happening all over the state. You can take a look at our Narcan Explainer online at nhpr.org. In a minute, we'll visit a different sort of training course where people learn to be recovery coaches.
To be able to say, you know, been there, done that, you know, it's a very powerful tool. I wouldn't be able to do this if I wasn't able to share my story.
When we return to Hope on the Front Lines from NHPR. You're listening to Hope on the Front Lines from NHPR. I'm Rick Gamble. There are many people and organizations working to reverse the opioid crisis. Producer Michael Brindley and I have been traveling around the state, talking with some of these people, working to make a difference at the ground level. One way people are trying to help is through recovery coaching, a peer support model that's growing in the state. Coaches support those in recovery by helping access treatment and other resources, like finding a job and a safe place to live as they try to get clean. To learn more, I recently joined about 40 people at a Recovery Coach Academy in a hotel conference room in Concord.
My name is Kathy Sari. I'm from New Ipswich, New Hampshire, and I pastor a church there.
Dave Simpson, full-time firefighter EMT with the town of Pittsfield.
I'm Melissa O'Brien, and I am from Nashua, New Hampshire. And I want to jump on that bandwagon to really learn how to combat this epidemic.
Everyone I speak to wants to help, but perhaps no one in the room is feeling a sense of urgency like Kyle McDonald of Franklin.
It's unfortunate, you know. I actually had a friend pass away just last night of an overdose. I got home after going to a recovery meeting, and I got home and, you know, come to find out my buddy's, he passed away, you know, and it's, I mean, this is just an amazing person, you know, someone who had so much to give and, like, love, and he's gone, and we're losing people like that, and that's just an example. Like, it happens every day.
When that something like that happens, when you get a phone call like that, what is your first thought?
I really just wonder what could have stopped it, because it's a waste.
Like many here, McDonald is in recovery himself, and he's taking this training as a way to help others who want to get clean.
I can't predict who or what I'm going to do with it. All I know is that this is something I feel that I need to do. I can't really explain it to you much other than that. Like, it's something that I need to do, and no matter what that looks like, I want my hand to be there for someone who wants to grab it.
There's so many people that want to do something to help, and this is kind of a way to, like, figure out how can I be a part of the solution.
Cheryl Pacapelli is Director of Community Engagement for New Futures, an advocacy organization that has trained more than 200 coaches in the past year.
We're seeing family members, people who have lost children or brothers or sisters.
They're seeing clergymen, EMTs, police officers, and even those on the other side of the law. Ginger Ross with the New Hampshire Alcohol and Drug Abuse Counselors Association shows me a letter she got from an inmate at the Concord State Prison.
He wrote me this passionate letter, and he indicates that he's 6 months sober, and he recognizes the value in recovery, and when he gets out in 18 months, he wants to be part of the recovery community to help others.
Recovery coaches are not licensed by the state and don't provide clinical services. But Ross explains the training can be a starting point for those looking to get into the professional field.
As a recovery coach, they will receive 30 credit hours that they can use towards their licensure of either a CRSW, which is Certified Recovery Support Worker, or if they're pursuing a career towards licensed alcohol and drug counselor, they can use those credits towards that.
And it's not just New Hampshire where recovery coaching is growing, says Jim Wolfing. He's running the training and helped write the Academy's curriculum.
Universally, we understand that treatment works, but what we haven't done that well as a society is support early recovery. Mm-hmm. That's why you see the revolving door, both in treatment and in criminal justice, and that's what recovery support service, so it's growing everywhere.
The process of recovery and getting into the recovery coaching. That's been really
as the morning gets underway, there's an open discussion with the class. The conversation veers into topics like ethics and personal biases. Many in the room open up about their fears of getting emotionally invested in their subject's recovery.
I mean, how do you not take it personally if you're working with someone and they just start spiraling into self-destruction?
The answer? Avoid the expectation that your help will be received.
The whole pain point of recovery coaching isn't I'm right and they're wrong. It is I'm meeting them where they're at. To put your love and your compassion and whatever resource you have to share with your recovery on the table, what the person does with that is up to them. It's not up to us.
So then what's the next one we're supposed to do?
What is cultural competence?
The walls in the rooms are covered with easel paper from brainstorming sessions held during the week. And the tables are covered with cans of Play-Doh and bite-sized candy. Kathy Sari, the pastor from New Ipswich, says the mood is often light.
Never a dull moment in this class. There's skits and things to help you get into the mode of learning. And yeah, very amazing class. I'd highly recommend it for anybody.
The five-day course costs $100, and everyone here has a different plan for what they want to do with the training. Sari runs support groups out of her church and plans to bring what she's learned back there. Dave Simpson, the firefighter and EMT from Pittsfield, says he's here to learn how to help those who've hit rock bottom get on a path toward recovery.
You know, studies suggest that within 24 hours of an overdose is when people are the most open to help. And, you know, we're there minute one.
And he says taking this class has opened his eyes.
I think my aha moment, so to speak, was speaking with my fellow classmates. You know, in this class, the majority of my classmates are people in active recovery, you know, and to hear their stories, it's just amazing, you know, how strong these individuals are.
One of his classmates in recovery is Carolee Longley of Northfield.
I've been one of the anonymous people that has been out there, you know, for almost 28 years, being clean and sober behind the scenes.
She sees the training as the start of her path toward working in the recovery field.
We're losing a generation. This is wiping out a generation. I have students I used to work with, and some of them, they're not here anymore, and just these kids are dying way too soon. So I feel like that is also a personal responsibility to try to do something about the heroin epidemic.
Still others, like Emily Duff from Lebanon, are here to help family members dealing with addiction. She's planning to bring back what she's learned to the Upper Valley, where she says resources are scarce for those who need help recovering from addiction.
I think it's maybe lack of funding. I think a lot of people don't want to deal with it. I don't think a lot of people want to face that there is an issue. But it's out there, and we need the help.
New Futures will hold its next Recovery Coach Academy next month in Keene. We continue our look at this peer-to-peer support model by meeting the recovery coaches taking on the crisis in Manchester, where more than 100 people died of overdoses last year.
And I hope everybody didn't load up on Red Bulls, because that is going to be a problem.
Despite those grim numbers, it is a surprisingly positive atmosphere here on a Thursday night at Hope for New Hampshire Recovery. It's a substance abuse recovery center in the heart of New Hampshire's largest city. Walking in, I see walls covered with messages of encouragement and support.
You can always tell when somebody comes in, like, hey, you having a bad day? What's up? You know, and they get you out of it. Your other peers get you out of that.
Kelly Riley is the recovery coach supervisor. There are about 20 paid coaches on staff here, along with another roughly 15 volunteers. There's a rotation, so there's always at least one coach on call for those who come through the door or respond to calls from out in the community. I've only been here a few minutes when a call comes in, fact. Someone's looking for help just a few blocks down the street at the city's central fire station.
We, no matter what, as recovery coaches, we walk over there, we'll get them. So we're going to take a walk over there.
We step out into a city that's been ravaged by this heroin and opioid addiction crisis. Walking along Pine Street, Riley explains this particular call is part of a new program, Operation Safe Station.
You can go to any fire station and go there and ask for help.
How many people have done that so far?
Oh, we've had at least 70. 70 calls. Not everyone has ended up with us, but we've kept several people. So as you can see, the ambulance is right there. This person has either overdosed or close to overdose, you know.
There's an EMT waiting outside as we walk up to the fire station.
So like this person here, we'll pick them up, we'll bring it back, and we'll talk to them over there. And start seeing, you know, what's going on, how you doing, what's your life like, you know, what are you addicted to. All right, I'll stay right here and then I'll go talk to him and see what's going on.
A few minutes later, she comes back out with a man in his early 20s. He's wearing a tattered black T-shirt and jeans, and he's carrying his belongings in a duffel bag. It turns out he's been to the recovery center before.
I remember you. I remember seeing you, and, you know, we can get you on the path to... Just knowing that you just went there, you're probably going to feel a little teeny bit better because you're doing a little bit, you know, for yourself.
Walking back, he opens up about his one-year-old daughter. He wants to get better for her, he says, but he's never been able to admit he needed help.
Well, you'll meet 100 other people that are the same way. Like, it's hard to ask for help.
Back at the recovery center, Riley gets him settled in.
Okay. gonna stick you. I'm gonna put you right over here. This is what we call the little cube here, okay? So I'm gonna put you here. I'm gonna go get one of the other coaches. So just get comfortable. There's like coffee right there if you wanna have a cup of coffee.
He meets with a coach and they start mapping out a recovery plan.
So, we have a meeting coming on over
here? No, I already know. It's all my fault.
The center is filling up quickly for tonight's Heroin Anonymous meeting. And looking around, it's impossible to tell the difference between the coaches and the members. And there's a reason for that.
We've all done those things, steal, lie, cheat, to get to what we needed, you know? So it's nice to be able to share that with somebody to say, hey, you don't have to feel alone because we've all been there. We've all done that.
Like many coaches, James Holloway was once an addict. It wasn't that long ago he was in the same place as those he's now helping. Now that he's clean, Holloway is helping others as a coach, but he's also reconnected with his family and is able to spend the weekends with his daughters.
The blessings that have come out of it are just like tenfold compared to my life before.
It's a familiar story here.
To be able to say, you know, been there, done that, you know, it's a very powerful tool. I wouldn't be able to do this if I wasn't able to share my story.
David Cody has been in long-term recovery for 25 years. He's another recovery coach on staff.
The rule here is 80-20. So we do 20% and the member does 80%. So I'll put them in front of a phone. I will give them phone numbers. But for the most part, they're the ones doing the calling.
But finding treatment isn't always easy. Many of the people coming in don't have insurance.
Obviously, we want to help people when they need it. And that window of opportunity is very narrow. So if we can get them on a wait list and keep them involved and keep them active, that keeps that window open that much longer.
And the need keeps growing. When the center first opened last summer, a few hundred people would show up in a month. Now it's upwards of 2,000.
I have seen a lot more people come in, and I see a lot of young people come in, which is, you know, is amazing. Because I figure if somebody can come in at 20 years old or 25 years old and find recovery, how many years of misery have we avoided for them, or have they avoided for themselves?
Later, I meet Coach Brian Patriquin. He's been in recovery for about 5 years.
Most people don't know what a recovery coach is. It's just a term that everybody throws around because that's really what we do, right? It's just we help coach, we encourage, we empower, we empathize with the individual who's seeking help.
So I'm going to show you like what this is back here.
In the back of the center, there's a room called Amber's Place. It's a space in the building where members can stay while waiting to get into treatment. Recovery coach supervisor Kelly Riley walks me through.
We have capacity for 16 we can have here, but and we were very close to that. Day before yesterday, we had like 8 pickups, like 8 people come in.
How long do they stay on average? I mean, is there an average stay?
We like to get you out between 3 to 5 days.
There are mattresses spread out across the floor, and it's where the man we picked up earlier in the evening will spend the night. People are free to go, and some do leave, sneaking out the back door. But for those who stay, there's always someone here to talk to.
Because we don't have any kind of funding, we rely on people to give their time, to be able to basically sit and listen to someone. And you see so much of that. People just want to talk to somebody that's not going to judge them.
And like others here, Riley is no stranger to addiction. She's in recovery, and she lost her son to a heroin overdose.
When I talk about it, which I talk about it a lot, I can get very emotional because it's a very emotional thing. We're so used to not showing our emotions, and people will be like, wow, I know what that feels like.
Recovery coaching isn't for everyone. Many do get burned out. David Cody, one of the coaches, says you've just got to focus on the small victories.
It really is about, I got somebody a phone number to a treatment center and he got on a wait list. That's something he didn't have when he came in. Or, you know, I found somebody, a safe place to live for the night.
And there's good news for the center. This summer, it will move into a larger space in a former furniture building in the city, where there will be more beds and housing for those in recovery. And you can see a video from my visit to Hope for New Hampshire Recovery. Look for Hope on the Front Lines on nhpr.org. What we heard again and again from recovery coaches is that there is no silver bullet for treatment. Dean Lemire is a recovery coach. He told us his story of addiction and recovery on NHPR's The Exchange. Host Laura Kanoy asked him to define what drug treatment is.
You know, what is addiction? You know, it's an illness that affects all areas of life, your biology, you know, your social life, your identity of self and other people. And it takes all, and your spirit, as I said at the last show, like your spirit takes a toll. And when we talk about, you know, a bottom that may or may not need to be reached in order to accept help, you know, that's the spirit. And, you know, all of these things need to be addressed. So the treatment has to be respectful of that and encompass the biology, the psychology, the social aspects and the spirit. You know, and there's no, you know, one addiction doesn't look like the next. There are as many recovery pathways as there are people embarking on those pathways. So, you know, I think if I were to make a smart, succinct answer to this question, it would be, you know, appropriate treatment would be, you know, to have options for different kinds of treatments. I was offered kind of one. Those options should be, you know, offered according to personal preference, you know, the opinion of a health professional and what the person's tried in the past, what worked, what didn't. A lot of people are kind of jammed through the same treatment modality over and over, and it ends in death and you know, kind of unnecessary death of the spirit where somebody just says, there's no hope for me. I can't do this recovery thing because this one modality isn't working for me. And then once a good treatment is decided on by all parties involved, you need immediate access. Because my story was 3 weeks of calling one treatment center that would take me based on my inability to pay, three times a day until 2.5 weeks in, I absolutely lost hope and caused, you know, just gave up on my chances. And caused a lot of property damage across a couple states and almost killed myself and some other people. So that's ineffective treatment.
So what did it look like when you finally found something that worked, Dean? And I'm struck, by the way, by what you said. Many people are jammed through the same treatment modality and might work for some but doesn't work for others. So what did yours look like? Was it medical? Was it talk therapy? Was it a residential center? What was it?
Well, while I was calling, in my mind, it was very medical. It was very bright. It was me strapped to a bed.
Oh, dear.
You know, and that's not what it was at all. It was, you know, some group therapy, mostly peer-based. It was essentially boot camp for the 12-step fellowships. And that worked for me. And, you know, I showed up. I hadn't had a meaningful relationship with anybody for at least a year and a half. I was, I was consuming illegal substances and I identified as a criminal. And it really affected all of my relationships until I really didn't have any except with my drug dealer in another state. So, you know, I showed up and suddenly I'm surrounded by people who have the condition that I have, but they're not dead. In fact, they have kind of like a light in their eyes. You know, I walked in, I was the first new person for 2 weeks, and some of these people had caught on to something real. And it was working for them for a time. You know, what also works for treatment is some follow through. You know, I went up to I lived in a halfway house for the next 3 months after 28 days of treatment. And that helped me bridge, you know, my old life and treatment and a new life out in the community as a totally new person trying to engage and live a lawful, meaningful life. And the 12-step fellowships carried me through till today, 4 years later. For 90% of the people I went through that particular treatment with, that isn't what worked.
Really? 90%?
I wasn't taking numbers, but I have a, you know, I go back and offer my help to the people in that treatment regularly. And I would say about 90%. So that was abstinence-based and really relying on the strong local 12-step fellowships. It works wonderfully for a lot of people, but in this time of an opiate, a fentanyl crisis, we need more options.
You can listen to the full discussion from The Exchange at nhpr.org. After the break, we'll look at some of the options to expand treatment for pregnant women and new mothers dealing with substance abuse.
10 years ago, if we had one or two of these children in a year, it was a very big deal for the staff.
Last year, 56 infants exposed to opioids were born at Concord Hospital. What's being done to help them? When we return to Hope on the Front Lines from NHPR. You're listening to Hope on the Front Lines from NHPR. I'm Rick Gamble. Producer Michael Brinley and I have been traveling around New Hampshire and speaking with some of those working to end the opioid crisis. One impact of the addiction epidemic has been a skyrocketing rise in newborns experiencing withdrawal after being exposed to opioids in the womb. From 2006 to 2011, the number of newborns in withdrawal more than doubled in New Hampshire, and hospitals say the problem is only getting worse. We visit Concord Hospital, where caregivers are working with these families and trying to ease the transition into life for these little ones.
Oh, make a nice face. Make a nice face.
I'm on a tour of the family place, the maternity center at Concord Hospital, and my guide, Center Director Barbara Pasco, can't resist picking up one of the newest arrivals.
I think what's so incredible is you think of a year in an adult life, and you really don't change much, and you think about a year in a newborn's life.
The amazing changes.
It's phenomenal. Days.
Pasco has been working with colleagues here at the hospital on how to make the transition to life easier for babies born with neonatal abstinence syndrome, or NAS.
And one of the things we have for NAS babies, it looks like they look like caterpillars. We pop them in, and it helps them self-soothe. What's that thing called?
A womby.
Last year, 56 infants exposed to opioids were born here. So far this year, there have been 26.
10 years ago, if we had one or two of these children in a year, it was a very big deal for the staff.
The withdrawal process can be traumatic for babies. They cry inconsolably and often can't sleep.
To watch a baby go through this is very... It's painful, and trust me, the guilt that these parents feel is palpable.
Tina Ferrin-Salmi is the hospital's neonatal nurse educator.
We've had babies that have gone upward of 24 hours of no sleep whatsoever, which we all know is not normal for a baby. A level of irritability. There can be a lot of GI symptoms as well. So they can be nausea or vomiting, diarrhea.
As the hospital saw more of these babies, the staff started experimenting with ways to soothe them. Pam Terrell gently plucks the strings on her harp. She's a certified music practitioner in the hospital's therapeutic arts department. She performs under the name DeLuna, and when she plays for NAS babies and their families, she starts with something slow and calming.
And then if it seems that the baby is comfortable with that, I may pick it up to a little bit more of a heart rate rhythm because babies' hearts are so fast, so I may pick it up and bring it into... A lot of the things that I hear from the nurses or the mother is, my baby just had a full feeding. It's the first time my baby has actually gone through that. And so that's huge. You know, that to me shows that there's a great comfort there and that they're starting to be more adjusting.
And babies may hear something different, like a Native American flute. Amy Sarasvati is another certified music practitioner at the hospital.
We are watching their breathing. We are watching their reaction. We're watching everything about, and we are really tailoring our service to what's happening for them. So there's a big difference between performance and therapeutic music.
The hospital has also been offering Reiki and aromatherapy delivered through oils with scents like peppermint and ginger soaked into cotton balls. Babies, they tell me, are particularly fond of lavender. Alice Kinsler, the hospital's therapeutic arts director, says they're able to actually see how music and scents help.
If the baby is being monitored on, let's say, a heart monitor or all their vital signs are being monitored, we can also see if their heart rate goes down. The musicians understand how to use their music so that they can sometimes even bring a heart rate down noticeably, and we can see it on the monitor.
Still, these soothing techniques are only complementary to the baby's medical needs.
We treat them with morphine, and they can wean off over a period of 8 days, 10 days, and go home like a normal newborn.
Barbara Pasco, the family place director, says it's during this critical time when nurses offer support and guidance to mothers, some of whom are still using illicit drugs.
We have this very little window of time where if a mother is going to make a change in her behavior, she's going to do it when she has a baby because there's a new little person that's depending entirely on her. And it's really not real until that baby is there and being held in her hands.
Many of the mothers go into treatment prior to birth, but maintenance drugs like methadone can still lead to NAS. In best-case scenarios, Tina Fernsalmi, the neonatal nurse educator, says the hospital's treatment begins prior to birth with pre-admission meetings.
A lot of these families are fearful that we're going to remove their baby from them as soon as it's born, and we're actually modeling and mimicking the exact opposite. We know that babies during their withdrawal process really have the best outcomes whenever they have a high level of interaction with their biologic parent.
And developmentally, outcomes for NAS babies are positive, though they're all referred for early intervention services as a precaution. And Fernsalmi says babies treated with morphine aren't at a higher risk for drug abuse later in life. That's something parents are often worried about. But mostly, she says, the hospital works to get rid of the stigma for these families.
All of us have probably made bad decisions in our past, but whenever you realize that you made a bad decision and you're actively on a path to do the right thing, then let's support that instead of continuing to keep it in the shadows and make it something dirty.
These are the continuing care rooms that I talked about earlier.
Of course, it's not always easy. Back at the family place, I talk with Pasco about how complicated many of the family situations can be.
I think the most challenging situation for us would be one where the mother has an issue and she hasn't shared it with her family or maybe even her partner. And then we get a lot of questions about why is the baby still here? Why is the baby getting medication? And because of patient confidentiality, we can't share that. And I think that the mothers are really selling themselves short in terms of the support that they would have available to them.
Yeah. Have you seen circumstances where there is multiple members of a family in addiction?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's what makes it really really important why we treat these patients and give them the skills they need, because when they go back out into the community, they may be going back into a situation that isn't conducive to the kind of care that we're providing and their ultimate goals.
And that's why the hospital keeps the care going for the mothers after they're discharged, offering lactation courses and a postpartum emotional support program. You can see a video from my visit to Concord Hospital at nhpr.org. Alcoholics Anonymous has become a well-known part of recovery, but now heroin anonymous meetings are popping up all over New Hampshire. These meetings are in large cities like Manchester and Nashua, but also in smaller towns where the addiction epidemic has taken a toll. I'm here in Newmarket. It's a town of about 9,000 people near the seacoast. The downtown is a string of quaint shops and renovated mill buildings right along the Lamprey River waterfront. I meet up with Kimberly Branch at a small hole-in-the-wall restaurant.
Johnny Boston's a great little spot to be. It's fast food, cook slow. This is just an awesome little place, good energy.
Branch works part-time here, one of her two jobs. There's a steady stream of reggae music playing as the lunch crowd comes in and out. We grab a booth, and before getting to her decision to start a Heroin Anonymous group here in town, Branch opens up about her own experience with addiction.
I started when I was 15. This was back in 99. My dad had passed away, and I started using everything I could get my hands on. And when I came across heroin, I absolutely fell in love, and I wanted more of it because I didn't want to feel the pain that I felt inside.
And after everyone she cared about had dropped her from their lives, Branch knew she needed to make a change.
it wasn't until I grieved with my own issues on the inside that I was able to realize this is not the life I want. I want to move on and do more with my life.
She's now 10 years sober, and between work and taking care of her two children, Branch is paying it forward by running weekly Heroin Anonymous meetings.
My whole thing is to try to help the addicts nowadays and to help them realize that, hey, I did it. I know you can do it too. I definitely believe that with all my heart.
Last fall, she reached out to a national Heroin Anonymous organization and got a starter pack of pamphlets and key tags, which are used to mark milestones of sobriety. And now, every Wednesday night, Branch hosts meetings at the Newmarket Community Church.
When I have my meeting, I like it to be comfortable. It's in a little spot upstairs in the church. There's couches in there, chairs. It's very comfortable. It's very relaxing. I like more of the peer counseling, to be there and counsel, but I do go by the 12 steps as well.
Is it kind of modeled after an AA sort of situation?
It is exactly modeled after the 12-step program, yes.
But unlike AA, Branch says having someone who's actually been down the path of heroin addiction makes all the difference.
Because I have been there, I think it means a lot more than going to an AA meeting and they have no idea what it's like to actually do heroin or be in that slump, that heroin slump.
I wanted to hear from the people that go to these Heroin Anonymous meetings. Branch offered to meet with members and use her cell phone to interview them. We've agreed to only use their first names.
Hi, my name's AJ. I'm 23, from Rochester, New Hampshire.
He got addicted to heroin after getting hooked on prescription medication following an injury. He stole, lied, and lost the ones he cared about.
Why are you going to Heroin Anonymous?
Well, I came to the conclusion that I can't really live my life the way I have been and that I just need to work on myself, and this seemed like the place to do it.
Branch also spoke with a woman named Aubrey, a recovering addict who's on her sixth time trying to stay clean. She says the hardest part of recovery is the isolation.
Most of the people I know around here are addicts or recovering addicts. I can get it with one phone call. It's pretty much, I feel like I'm sheltered. I just stay in my room because, like, you know, if I go out, then I feel like I'll end up doing something stupid.
Why do you go to Heroin Anonymous now?
I like to listen to other people's stories because it makes me feel better, like I'm not alone.
Back at the restaurant, Branch tells me she's run about 30 meetings so far, and each one is different.
We have people come and go. So I've had one person that I sat there and talked to, and I've had seven or eight people I've sat there and talked to. It's up and down. You never know what's going to happen. I have to show up every Wednesday at the same time and just hope that someone comes to hang out with me and talk about some addiction.
Those who do come to the meetings are in all stages of recovery. Some are court-ordered to attend meetings, and Branch signs off on the papers for them. And sometimes people show up to the meetings high, but Branch does not turn them away.
They sit there, they nod out, whatever. It's distraction for my other people that do want help, and it's kind of a slap in the face, and I would rather them not come messed up. I'd rather them come clean and be serious about their recovery. It doesn't always happen that way.
And while she'll point people in the direction of treatment, there's only so much she can do.
Ultimately, what's going to get you sober is yourself. It's when you decide that you are tired of living the same way you've lived in your addiction and you want a different, you want something different, you want something more.
Branch is just one of the everyday people in town trying to help. John Kuiper is another. He owns this restaurant and he joins us in our booth. He's part of a community coalition called Newmarket Alliance for Substance Abuse Prevention. The group has held forums in town and come up with ways to address the problem. Kuiper got involved after he learned one of his employees was an addict. And as part of the coalition, he's learned getting people help isn't easy.
I think the hardest part is that it's not like there's a bunch of addicts that are like in line ready to like get help. Most of them don't want help. So we kind of got all geared up and then it was kind of like, wow, there's like really limited amount we can do. And then the biggest problem is that there's only so much we can do without any money and with so few beds.
Kuiper says it's frustrating to see that firsthand. He says that former employee who was using couldn't afford rehab. And after going to jail for 3 months, he's back out and using again.
And so, I mean, the state ended up paying, what is that? It's got to be at least $6,000. You know, what did it 3 months in jail to do nothing. It's not like there's a lack of money. It's just the resources being used in such an illogical way.
Still, the coalition is doing what it can. Branch says it is raising awareness and creating resources within the community, like the Heroin Anonymous meetings, and for others here in Newmarket affected by the crisis.
They've started a support meeting for the people, the family of the addicts. So there's also that option in town. When we have an issue arise, we try to solve it instead of just turning our heads to it.
And that's a message we heard throughout our travels around the state. Hope on the Front Lines was written and produced by Michael Brindley. We're grateful to those who took the time to tell us their stories and talk with us about what they're doing to help in the fight against addiction. Special thanks to reporter Casey McDermott for her extraordinary pictures and video. You can find those online at nhpr.org. I'm Rick Ganley. Hope on the Front Lines is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.